This is The Book Show. Coming up, a 1980s bohemian New York childhood in I.O. Tillett's memoir and ghost stories told on the move. But first, a big congratulations to all the shortlisted nominees for the Bord Gáis Energy Irish Book Awards, which were announced earlier this week. And tonight, we bring you Lucy Caldwell, whose short story, Here We Are, was shortlisted in the Best Short Story category. It's taken from her collection Multitudes, and all the stories are drawn from Lucy's upbringing in East Belfast. I recently met Lucy Caldwell in Belfast to explore some of the places featured in the book and began by joining her at her family home on the outskirts of the city.
Thank you.
So is this the house you grew up in?
It is. This is the house that my parents moved to when I was 11. And so it feels very much my childhood home.
And we passed the C.S. Lewis house just further down the road, which do you used to pass it on the way to school?
Yeah, every day on my way to school I would walk past C.S. Lewis's house. This collection of stories, I started writing it about 11 years ago, and I saw perfectly in my head all the stories were going to be narrated by girls or young women. They were all going to show a different side to the city. They were going to tell stories that I thought hadn't been told before. Stories that, when you're living at a time of a bigger narrative, it can suck the oxygen away from all of the other smaller stories. I wanted the collection to be more than just a random selection of stories. I wanted it to have a real shape and arc to it. I wanted it to be almost a cubist portrait of growing up. So the stories are arranged in order the protagonists and narrators get older as the story collection goes on. Here we are. This summer is a washout. Every day the heavens open and the rain comes down. Not the usual summer showers with their skittish, shivering drops, but heavy, dull, persistent rain. True dreich days. The sky is low and grey and the ground is waterlogged. The air cold and damp, blustery. We don't care. It is the best summer of our lives.
So we've got stories about young love and about young gay love. We've got stories about people feeling adrift from friends and being sort of lonely and friendless. Is there a sense that sometimes, and it's happened with a lot of Irish writers, that you have to go away to be able to write about a place? And was that like that for you? Because you don't live in Belfast and haven't for a while.
Now, there's a real irony to doing this interview about my collection of stories, all of which are about young people, all of which are about growing up and leaving home, right back in my childhood home. A lot of the stories are about being torn between two places. The poet Nick Laird has a great quote. He talks about being reared for export, the sense that you're being brought up to make another life elsewhere. Although I've moved away, although my husband is a Londoner and we have a two-year-old that we're raising in East London, my heart draws me back here. My emotional heartland seems to be East Belfast. I set my novels here, my plays here, this collection of short stories. I think, interestingly though, the history of Ireland has so long been one of emigration, and it's only in more recent years that we're seeing a lot more immigrants, even in Belfast, which when I grew up was such a monocultural place. I think it's those stories that are going to be the most refreshing and that are going to change things.
So we are in your upstairs bedroom, looking down at the lovely pond and the garden. Is this where, I mean, I read voraciously as a child. Is this where you used to do all your reading and sort of dreaming?
This is where I used to do all of my reading and dreaming. I'd be curled up here for hours and hours with a book. Obviously the posters of, I don't know, Jared Leto have long gone. That dates me pretty specifically.
What sort of books did you read? What were formative writers for you?
Some of the books are still here on my shelf. Here's John Wyndham Chalky, Diana Wynne Jones' Witch Week, and the Susan Cooper books. The Dark is Rising series quintet was my adolescent comfort reading.
Coming of age stories are really compelling to read, and I think a lot of writers are drawn to them because these are very changeable characters. They're in a period of flux in their lives because of their age and their hormones and all sorts of things. So why did you focus in on teenage characters, and what is it about them? There's a lot of boredom, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of, you know, dramatics.
I think those teenage years are such perilous and terrifying years when you're changing despite yourself, when you don't necessarily have any control over what's happening to you or what you might be, when you have all this sense of having new powers that you don't know quite how to control or how to handle. At the same time, they're the most stultifying years. You know, everything is mapped out for you. You don't have that much agency necessarily. It's a really strange mixture of trying to push against the boundaries of life as it's set for you and working out who you might be, who you might become, being terrified of that and finding it thrilling at the same time. So this is my East Belfast. These are the streets I grew up on, the parks that I walked past, the trees and the buildings and the roads and the places that were most familiar to me.
So Lucy, we've left your lovely home and you've taken us on a walk maybe 5 minutes away, and we're standing in this gorgeous park. So why have you brought us here? What's the significance of this place?
Well, this park, Cairnburn Park, properly called Belmont Park, is the central setting for my short story 13, which is in particular about how hard it is to leave childhood behind. It was the place when I was a young teenager where people would come and they would drink underage and they would get up to all sorts. And I was so terrified of growing up at that age. And so somewhere like this, which by day is a place for children, but by night becomes something wilder and more out of control and possibly more sinister, it seemed a metaphor of that transition that we all have to make between childhood and into adolescence.
Would you read a section from 13 for us?
We weave up the road together like a bad three-legged race. It's still mizzling, but even the rain feels less wet with the strawberry ravers inside you. An old lady mutters at us as we pass her, something about a night like this and the pair of yous in your figures. And we start giggling and then we start laughing and laugh the rest of the way. When we get to Cairnburn Park, there are a few groups there already, at the benches in the kiddie playground. We stand at the fence by the playground, looking for people from our year. The only light is from the streetlights on Cairnburn Road, running along the far side of the playground. I know Cairnburn Park. I walk past it every day on my way to school, and when we do cross country in PE, we run circuits around it. I try to remind myself of this, but even the trees look somehow different in the dark.
So Lucy, we don't have much time left, but there's one place that I would really like to see, and I know is really central to the book, which is Cypress Avenue. So would you bring us there?
Yes, of course, let's go.
Well, I'm caught one more time up on Cypress Avenue.
Lucy, we're standing on Cypress Avenue in Belfast, and I think for a lot of people this will be associated with maybe Van Morrison, and you've talked about laying out the stories in a very album-like way in the collection that is Multitude. So what does this place mean to you?
Van Morrison describes it as a mystical place. You see the trees, the really tall trees and the wide pavement and the big setback detached houses. He talked about it as a place he could come to dream, a place where he could think of different kinds of life and allow a sense of the spiritual, I suppose. And I think nowhere do you feel that more keenly with Van Morrison's music than in his album Astral Weeks.
Say so hard than a carriage. Should return them from
the... You've said that listening to Van Morrison talking about all the places, and he talks about a lot of places in his work, that you learned the streets of Belfast from his music more than you sort of learned them yourself walking around. Tell me about that.
Yes, Van Morrison seems to be playing almost constantly in my childhood memories. But what I remember very keenly is one day my mum taking a detour from where we were driving and showing us, this is Cypress Avenue, that's in the song. And I was quite young at the time, but I was really struck by, it seemed really magical, as if something had broken its boundaries. You know, here was something that belonged in the realm of stories and the realm of songs, and yet there I was. I remember paying attention to place for the first time. And for that reason, I think that the streets of East Belfast, the streets that I call my own, they were first real to me through the music of Van Morrison.
Way up on, 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 way up
After we leave Cutter's Wharf that night, we walk. We walk along the Lagan and through the Holy Lands, Palestine Street, Jerusalem Street, Damascus Street, Cairo Street. We cross the river and walk the whole sweep of the Ormo embankment. The tide is turning and a two-person canoe is skimming downriver, slate grey and quicksilver. When we reach the point where the road curves away from the river, the pale evening light still lingers, so we keep walking across the Ravenhill Road, down Toronto Street and London Street and the London Road, Rosebery Road and Willowfield Drive and across the Woodstock Road and on, further and further east, until we are in Van Morrison territory, Hindford Street and a Better Parade, Grand Parade, so the North Road, Orangefield.
14 Yeah, no.
And Multitudes is published by Faber. The Bord Gáis Energy Irish Book Awards will be held on November 16th, and we wish Lucy the very best of luck. Highlights of the awards will be screened on RTÉ 1 television on Saturday, November 19th. Well, with Halloween just around the corner, readers looking for a chill will no doubt be dusting off their well-worn copies of The Turn of the Screw and A Warning to the Curious. But thanks to Dublin playwright Peter Dunn, there's a new way to experience ghost stories in audio form. Eerie is a ghost story experience where listeners pop on their headphones and are guided on a haunted walking tour of Dublin City that starts from Smock Alley Theatre. We went for a creepy stroll with Peter, the writer and director of Eerie, to find out more about the stories he's written for the tour.
There's Dublin that you see all the time, the big famous sites and the big famous places, but there's kind of another Dublin if you really look for it, all these little nooks and crannies and side streets and historical things that are just hidden in the middle of this big city. Even just that tunnel thing we passed through, you know, not many people even know that's there. It's not a case of just kind of looking around you, you have to look above you and underneath you and behind you.
You out there, listening to my voice, listening to this recording, I make something clear. You do this of your own free will. You do this of your own power. Listen to his voice. And although he'll tell you where to go, although he'll tell you what to do, it is your own responsibility what becomes of you.
I'm Peter Dunn. I'm a writer from Dublin. I'm also behind Morb, which started off as a series of underground film nights and now has branched out into this audio tour. Eerie is a haunted ghost tour of the city centre. Files of this occult debunker and investigator, and he is telling you about the ghost stories he collected over the city. He is telling you...
When I was a kid, they said if I looked into a mirror by candlelight and called for a banshee 5 times, she would appear. I'd usually be at about 50 before I was told to go to bed. I loved talk of the uncanny because to me, it was a joke. Even more hilarious, but then eventually so depressing, were the poor saps who believed in this rubbish. This made me so angry, I became a debunker, devoted to stopping the gullible from believing in spirits.
I love ghost stories. I love people telling me a story. What you don't see and what you imagine are far worse than what you'll ever know. A book you love is because you pictured the characters a certain way, is because, you know, you pictured how they lived, how they act a certain way. That isn't necessarily exactly what's on the page, that you kind of go off on your own little tangents. And that's kind of what's good with ghost stories, that you will always go off on your own little tangents. There are certain books or short stories I've read, like M.R. James said, I've actually jumped in fright while reading it. We're just outside Marsh's Library now. If you haven't been in before, it's well worth a look. It's really beautiful. They still have all the old cages that they used to lock readers in so they wouldn't be able to steal the books. It's actually supposed to be haunted as well by the guy who found it, Narcissus Marsh, I think his name was, and apparently his niece was eloping, and so she left a note for her uncle to explain what she was going to do, and she hid it in one of his books. But he never found the note before he died. So apparently his ghost is still looking through all the books, slamming the books down, looking for this note. But like any true good librarian, he puts the books exactly back where he found them. We're actually just passing by a location that's going to remain secret that appears in the tour. It's a resting point for people taking the tour where they'll get to sit down and listen to a 1950s radio show.
From darkest Africa, the curious Far East, and plain old weird Europe, this is World of the Strange. This evening's true curiosity comes from the fairy-filled land of Ireland. So grab your shillelagh and drink down your poutine as we present our newest tale of terror, The Bottom of the Morning to ya.
Halloween is just the best time of year. Maybe it's just in my head, but the whole city seems to change. It gets this new energy, and especially for, you know, writers or people who love to read. You know, growing up, my family were really big into Halloween. And then, you know, I'd read horror to my brothers and sisters when they were younger. So it's kind of like I associate with like family and, you know, sharing time with people that you love. I'd make up like stories about, we found a suitcase out the back that belonged to two children that lived here years ago, but they were murdered. And so my brothers and sisters have to like figure out all these clues in the house. They'd be terrified. Even now, I'll still have Halloween parties for my family. And, you know, I'll say, well, to the kids, oh, well, you have to go upstairs with this lantern and find a clue. And they'd be crying. And in a, and in a very sick way, this was very satisfying for me. It's a great way to see an unusual part of the city, to hear some stories that you probably wouldn't hear otherwise. People do so many of these walking tours or, you know, ghost tours where you're just, you're kind of in a group and you're corralled and something like that. Like with this, you have a little bit of power, but it also has the opportunity to be a little bit scarier because you don't have the safety of the group. I would love if, like, you know, some tourists come over to do the tour actually went back to their own countries thinking that some of these stories were true.
And that was Peter Dunn speaking there about the power of the ghost story. And Eerie, a new audio ghost experience, is running in Smock Alley Theatre, Dublin, for the foreseeable future, and available from the box office with full details on smockalley.com/Eerie. And if you'd like two tickets to go along to that, follow us at BookshowRTE, tweet us the word Eerie, and we'll pick a winner at random. Now, Io Tillett's new memoir, Darling Days, tells the story of a boy born into a body he did not identify with. His parents were eccentrics living in the squalor of New York's East Village of the 1980s. As a child, he was surrounded by characters you might see in Nan Golden photographs. In fact, Nan Golden was his godmother, and Io too is a photographer. He spent many years photographing almost 10,000 LGBTQ people across America, and we spoke to him from a London studio and asked him about where his parents were at when he was born.
Well, my parents were just hot in the 80s, pretty much, is how I happened. My mother's love of her life had been murdered by the police in rather mysterious circumstances, under mysterious circumstances, 2 years before I was born. And that kind of upended her whole world, and she'd kind of taken to swigging Johnny Walker and blasting the Ramones and screaming back into the speakers all night because she was dealing with agonizing grief. She was an actress, and she'd heard that a filmmaker was making an avant-garde version of Ophelia in the East Village, and so she went down to inquire about the role and knocked on the door, and my father opened it. And he, of course, was taken with her and invited her in and said she could sleep on his kitchen floor. And 5.5 months in, he saw her touching her belly a lot and was like, I think you might be pregnant. And she said, nah, no way. And it turns out she was. Yeah, I was born on a block that has a 700-man men's shelter that's like a halfway house for people on their way either out of jail or into a mental institution or out of a mental institution. And it was 1985, so New York was in the midst of, you know, the AIDS crisis, and crack was appearing, and the Hells Angels had their headquarters a block away, so it was just pure chaos. And then out pops a little baby.
You describe your mother, it's a wonderful sentence, as one part unicorn, three parts thunderstorm, and two parts wounded bull.
Yeah, that's very much her. She's a force. I never saw her sit down my whole childhood, ever. And to this day, I guess she'd probably be 60 or 61, she rides her bicycle everywhere. In the dead of winter, in the blaze of summer, it doesn't matter. She's out there on her bike. My mom is a force, and she survived things that are unimaginable to other people by, I think, keeping a forward momentum going.
You say in the book that it was really important for you to be weird, and that if you weren't a drag queen or a performance artist or a creative person, you were the one that was odd, that stood out. So did you strive to be different from the get-go, or was that sort of something that happened because of your parents and the people you were around?
Yeah, I didn't know any different. There was no, I can say that now as an adult, because as an adult, I understand the concept of us being the weird ones or us being marginalized, but we were doing the marginalizing. We didn't want the quote unquote normies around us anywhere, and they weren't. I didn't grow up with anybody that wasn't like that. So I didn't have any concept of people who were square or conservative or conventional until I was, I guess, in my teens. And then I became aware of the bubble that the rest of the world lived in. And I was like, oh, wait, I'm on the outside of something. But I didn't know that, you know. My circle of normalcy was all unicorn and fairy dust.
In the acknowledgments of this book, you credit every person who had the opportunity to force me into a box in my formative years and didn't. The idea of labelling people is something that you also touched on in a TED Talk some years back. So how do you think you would have fared in, say, a more mundane household?
My mom, my dad really, or any of the people that I grew up with could be easily classifiable as drug addicts or deviants, or my mom could be classified as a neglectful mom. But when it comes down to it, everybody comes from somewhere, and everybody's dancing with some pain and trying to figure out how to navigate it and do their best. And I don't find classifying people singularly like that to be beneficial or compassionate. I think that if I had been forced to wear dresses my whole adolescence, I probably would have killed myself. I think that I probably would have ended up a statistic. I can't imagine. I have had to imagine a lot what that's like, because in traveling to all 50 states over the last 6 years and photographing 9,800 people, I've met many, many, many people for whom that was their experience, whether they were forced to act heterosexual or they were forced to act like the gender that they felt was wrong for them. I think I would have ended up a statistic if I had also been forced to be a girl.
You didn't end up a statistic, and at 13, you took a very brave decision and decided to open up about the situation at home, particularly with your mother, to a guidance counsellor. But what was the breaking point for you where you thought, I have to talk to somebody about my mum?
I went to a new school. I had grown up in this very alternative environment and this alternative school where they didn't force me to do anything, girl or boy. It was more the other kids who would ask questions, but I had kind of figured out a system and I had it wired. And then I graduated from that school when I was 11, and I went to this new one when I was 12, and they were very strict and very conventional and had gender segregated locker rooms. And as I was going to sports class the first day, the teacher was like, okay, we'll go down to the locker rooms. And I realized, oh my God, this is going to be a year of torture, because I can't go in the girls' locker room and I can't go in the boys' locker room, and panic attack. And so I ended up with the school guidance counselor. And it was something about her in particular. She was such a compassionate human being, and she didn't look at me like I was a circus animal. She just kind of like said, why can't you go in the girls' locker room? And I said, well, because I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. And then she said, well, why can't you go into the boys' locker room? And I said, well, I'm not actually a boy, but I'm not a girl. And she said, okay. And then just kind of waited for me to explain. So when she eventually got around to being like, so tell me about your home life, I think being in a context where it was revealed to me how abnormal my life with my mom was. We had been fighting constantly. I didn't sleep very much. We often didn't have electricity. Food was very scarce. And when it was around, it was kind of strange. And I was malnourished, and I was sleep deprived, and I was sick all the time. I had tonsil infections twice a year, and I felt there was a genuine risk to my health if I stayed. And my dad lived in Germany, and I just thought, oh, he lives in this safe home. I would have a bed if I slept at his house, and I didn't have a bed. I had an army cot at my mom's house. So I felt safe with her, and I decided to trust her and tell her what my home life was like, knowing that it was going to lead her to be horrified and do something about it. And then eventually she said, okay, well, your home life is awful. Would you like to call the Bureau of Child Welfare? But if we do that, you can't go back. And I don't know where I got the courage to just say yes. I guess I just believed I had to, and I said yes. And then you'll have to read the book to find out what's next.
And reading the book is something I'd recommend, because there's so much in it about identity and art. It was great to speak to you and to hear you speak so honestly about your experiences. So I wish you the best of luck with the book and for the future.
Thank you so much. Very much the same.
And that brings us to the end of the book show for this week. But if you want to go to a book-related event, the International Summit of the Book is on in Limerick next week. Details at summitofthebook2016.com. We'll be back here next week with a preview of some of the writers being featured at this year's Dublin Book Festival. My thanks to producer Regan Hutchins and to series producer Zoe Cummins.